Hello, and welcome to the Degree of Freedom podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber, and today we're going to be joined by Kathy Davidson, professor of English at Duke University, author of Now You See It, How Technology and Brain Science Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Learn, and the professor behind the upcoming Coursera MOOC on the history and future of higher education. Professor Davidson is my favorite type of person to discuss the MOOC phenomena with, a devoted teacher in a traditional discipline, in her case literature, who is both grounded in history and excited about what new technology could do for students in the future. In her case, the background she brings to understanding what's happening today with MOOCs and other free learning resources is a history of technology, specifically technology used to disseminate information. And just as today's technology-based learning tools inspire both hope and fear among students, teachers, parents, administrators, and other societal stakeholders, older new media, such as the mass-produced novel, also triggered an avalanche of heated opinions, some informed, some not. This has allowed Davidson to enter our new educational world with eyes wide open through her own technology-enabled innovations in the classroom, through the extensive collaboration work she's done with other educators, and through a new MOOC she's creating that will be released through Coursera in early 2014. If history teaches us anything, is that there's very little happening today technology-wise that doesn't have past precedent from which we could draw important lessons. For instance, the disruptive shrinkage of distance through communication devices such as the telephone can help us understand societal reaction to tools like the internet, just as today's revolution in publishing based on both new production and distribution methods has precedent in earlier iterations of the book. This kind of perspective is vital to understanding the changing world of education beyond this week's controversy or next week's product announcement. And history also teaches us that no technology is perfect, including the relatively established digital audio recording technology I'm using to create this podcast, which I'm using as an excuse to explain the annoying echo you might hear now and again during the interview, which I decided to just fess up to in advance rather than cut any of the insightful things today's guest has to say. So without further ado, Kathy Davidson, welcome to Degree of Freedom.
Thank you for having me, John.
Now, Kathy, I tried to sum up your background in my introduction, but your work spans so many fields that I wanted to let you talk about how you feel the many disciplines you've taught and written about fit together.
Well, I think my main interest in all the different fields I've taught is about history of technology, but mainly the way that technology changes social relations, educational requirements, and economic relations. So I've been very interested in that, whether in Revolution the Word, a book I wrote some years ago, I was looking at mass printing and what happens when steam-powered presses, machine-made paper, and machine-made ink make books cheap enough to be available to working-class and middle-class readers for the first time in history. And now I've switched and I sort of used the same kind of rubric to talk about new technologies and especially what happened on April 22nd, 1993, when the Mosaic 1.0 browser was commercialized. And suddenly, for the first time in human history, you could have a thought, communicate that thought, and anyone else with an internet connection could access that thought without a publisher, without a printer, simply you and your computer talking to the world or to the world that has access to a computer. So I think that's the continuity. And then I've also have a subfield interest in brain science. So I've done a lot of work on cognition and how print and new forms of media, new forms of communication change the way we see the world. Very Jamesian or Kantian view. The technologies around us actually change the way we see the world.
And as a literature person, you've talked about some interesting parallels between today's technology-based learning and previous technology-enabled cultural breakthroughs, such as the novel. Can you expand on that subject a little bit?
Sure. Many of the founding fathers were appalled that now that books were available to the masses without the intercession of a priest or a governor or some other kind of councilman from your local community interpreting what was said, that people didn't turn to reading great books. They read popular novels that featured middle-class and working-class people like themselves. And many of the founding fathers thought all kinds of horrible things would happen. And some of them will sound very familiar because it's what we think is happening now with video games and promiscuous use of the internet. And promiscuous was a big word for the novel. People thought it would lead to laziness, distraction. This is too much novel reading. A dilution of great literature in favor of mediocre literature. A decline in standards. Lack of morality. And interesting pedophilia. They thought that suddenly young people would be reading these books and all of their defenses were down and it would make them prey to strangers. So basically, when people started saying the same things in the late 20th and early 21st century about the internet, all my sensors went up, and I said, well, this sounds pretty much like what John Adams and Thomas Jefferson said about the novel. And I've often made the quip that the video game is the novel of the 21st century, or that the novel was the video game of the late 18th century. And I think partly what we're just saying is there's a generational difference, and we don't get it, so the young people have to be bad. And this technology is somehow leading them astray.
Now, your latest book is called Now You See It, with that requisite provocative subtitle of How Technology and Brain Science Will Transform Schools and Business for the 21st Century. So what is brain science telling us about learning, and how do you think technology will transform schools and businesses in the 21st century?
The particular form of brain science I'm very interested in is the way attention blindness, or what psychologists sometimes call inattentional blindness, which is basically the way we frame and filter the world, if we want to use Kant's word, of that we don't really see the world, we just see a certain frame of it or a filter of it that is conditioned by our culture, our language, by those who love us from the time we're born. Infants don't know how to pay attention. Infants pay attention to anything, and our job is to tell them what is or isn't worth their attention. So we've all seen the phenomenon of the little baby who's captivated by rotating fan blades. And basically we're saying no to that baby all the time. The fan blades aren't important. Grandpa or grandma is important. Pay attention here. And we're learning language at the same time we're getting affection, we're getting positive reinforcement, negative reinforcing for a whole array of cultural values that are also shaping what we see and what we don't see. Another great example, one of my favorite examples, is we in the West often make fun of the Japanese for not being able to tell the difference between R and L. So rice and lice sound the same to a Japanese person. That's because Japanese language makes no distinction between R and L. An infant Japanese baby can tell the difference between R and L. This has been tested with all kinds of fancy new data processing machinery. By about the age of 6 months, as a child is starting to come into the phonemic introduction to language, understand the sound vocabulary of their language, rhythms and cadences, Japanese babies stop being able to hear the difference between R and L because it's not important in their society. And as an adult, if they learn English where R and L are two different sounds, they have to relearn something they had to learn as a baby. It's a wonderful metaphor for the way all of our senses, all of our understanding of the world gets conditioned by what is or isn't important in our world. What happens when there's a massive technological change, such as has happened since the internet became popular, is suddenly there's a new set of skills that are demanded and another set of skills that just aren't relevant anymore. So if I'm a middle-aged person, I might feel very perturbed that my young child doesn't want to learn to memorize phone numbers anymore, or even all kinds of things, because my child might say, I'll Google it. Within that world, that's perfectly fine. Within my world, it's jarring because there's a distinction between what I valued and the way I pay attention to the world and what my child is being conditioned to value. And this is an old thing in the history of technology, too. In the 17th century, people thought slide rules would end mathematics, that nobody would be able to think mathematically again because of the invention of the slide rule. In the 1830s at Yale, a math professor introduced the blackboard. The students rioted because they thought he was destroying their mental capacities for recitation by introducing a blackboard. It was ruining and demeaning them as human beings, and they rioted and were all kicked out of school and had to come back and promise they would accept the blackboard. So it happens with almost all new technologies that there's a period where we really think it's going to destroy us. It doesn't really destroy us, but it does change us. What we need, what we depend on, does change which things are or aren't important in our world and changes how we pay attention. My polemical argument is that not only will schools change, but they should change to support the kind of technology that is so crucial to our lives today, that we should be teaching kids more about the opportunities of the technologies they encounter, but also the challenges and the downsides of the technologies, or more like the limitations of the technologies, or the ways they can get in trouble if they're not careful using the technologies. And certainly, as we know from the case of people like Anthony Weiner, you don't have to be a kid to get in trouble with technology. But there's lots of digital literacies we all need to learn about privacy, propriety, identity online, all of those things.
One of my favorite books last year was The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, which seemed to be making the case that you're making, that while we, of course, build and change the technology is also having a transformative effect on us.
Actually, Nick Carr and I are often on panels together, and we do have very similar assumptions about the transformative potential of technology. He tends to put a negative and moralistic valence on it. I tend to think it doesn't matter if I'm negative and moralistic. It's here to stay. So I really want pragmatically to come up with the best possible ways of making use of the technology that is here to stay. And how can we use it more creatively and not whine about how it's destroying kids? And, you know, his famous article was something like, is Google making us stupid or does Google make us stupid? Well, it only makes us stupid if we keep our own particular set of values and apply those to a different generation. And I'm not very keen on nostalgia.
Now, you've actually been doing your own experiments in innovative teaching and learning. Can you talk about how you've been putting some of your own ideas into practice?
Since I believe that one feature of the internet that is really, really crucial is this ability to have an idea and communicate that idea without an editor or a publisher censoring that, or even a parent if you're working on your computer alone or texting or whatever, without anyone to censor, that one of the things you have to do is learn a new kind of self-censorship, self-publishing, self-control, and think of your public expression always as a form of self-publishing, and that it has a kind of duration and an impact and a consequence in the world. So I now teach my classes so my students do everything in public. They don't write term papers anymore. They write not only blogs, but analytical blogs that they then debate with one another. And there's always two students in charge of a class each week where they read all of these blogs and determine whether the blogs are the equivalent of having written a paper that week. I do contract grading, but it's students who sign off on whether the public blogs have met the contract. And if they think not, then they have to give feedback, and the other students have to respond to the feedback, and then the students in charge again decide whether with the feedback the student's work is satisfactory. So the class is a lot about interactiveness, giving feedback, taking feedback. I learned a lot of this from sitting in an art and architecture crits where supposedly the soft field of art is savage. I mean, you just as an art student have to learn to have your precious work torn apart by other people, and that helps you then become better at it and learn to be a better artist. It's a process we don't use in many other fields, but I think it's absolutely crucial if we're going to be responsible and creative and responsive citizens of the internet. So I base all my classes now on teaching evaluation, teaching how we evaluate and how we learn from evaluation in a very candid but also fruitful way. So it's also about collaboration. That's the second text, subtext there, is that thinking is a collaborative act.
I'm curious, well, where do you think MOOCs are going to fit into this transforming educational landscape?
Well, I'm actually quite skeptical about MOOCs because I've spent the last 10 years running a nonprofit called HASTAC, which is it's a long acronym, HASTAC, Humanities, Arts, Science, Technology Alliance, and Collaboratory. And it's really thinking about new ways that we can work and do research and projects together online, both in the classroom and outside the classroom. The thing I dislike about MOOCs is they're so top-down. And so many of the MOOCs start with professors at elite universities, famous professors, sort of spreading the gospel to the masses via the video and via the internet. And since I really dislike lecturing as a form, but I really admire the one thing about lectures, which is being in a room together with other people to be inspired by something. That does seem to be a fundamental human quality. We like to go to football games and churches and movies together, and we like to hear lectures together, witness the TED Talks. But online, you don't even have that sense of community, but you still have the hierarchy of one person giving you the truth. The so-called sage on the stage is now the doc on the laptop. And so I am going to be teaching a MOOC in the spring. I'm filming it now on the history and future of higher education. But I'm actually trying to turn the camera around so that the students, and we think there'll be 50 or 100,000 students, are part of the process of making the future of higher education. So the assignments include things like a timeline that goes back to 1800, where one assignment will be to find something really interesting that happened in your country, your county, your state, or locale in a 10-year period and put it on our timeline. And then some other student has to come by and edit it and give you a badge if they think that you did a good job, or just not give you a badge if they don't think you did a good job. So again, there will be some kind of editing and evaluation and contribution. But to my knowledge, there's never been a timeline of 50,000 people contributing information about events in their local education arrayed in this way. I think it's going to be an incredibly interesting, if anecdotal, research tool for the future. So I like being able to use the MOOC in that way, to use massive in a helpful way, not just one person talking to the masses, but people massively contributing to a different kind of history, an international, local, kind of a locavore of the history and future of higher education.
Actually, it was one of your Duke colleagues. First course I took was a Duke class on logic and argumentation that I thought made the best use of the masses. The course ended with a argument contest in which everybody was asked to use arguments either on video or written that were then evaluated and voted on, and then the professors used to analyze for the final set of classes. It was far from perfect, but I thought it was an interesting use of the numbers of students in the class.
I love that. I was so pleased. I took that class as well, and I was so pleased when I saw that assignment at the end. And I know Walter's now working on another version where he's actually using that feedback to improve the course for the second time around. I've got a team of assessment people, graduate students at North Carolina State University, who are going to be working on my Coursera class with me, and we're going to be using four different assessment tools at the same time and comparing what the results are that we're getting from the different assessment tools. And I think that's going to be really interesting. One is a tool, in fact, invented by a doctoral student at NC State University, which allows for pretty sophisticated machine-generated feedback of essay questions. I've not used it yet. I've only seen it demonstrated. I can't wait. I think it's going to be fascinating.
I'd be extremely interested in that. Yeah, I think if you've read the Degree of Freedom site entries on assessment, that's has generally been one of the weaker areas in MOOC so far.
Yes, and that's why I'm hoping we're going to be able to make a contribution in that area. I don't know if we will or not. It'll be an experiment, but even doing the experiment is exciting.
And this is your first MOOC course, you said, so what's it been like putting one together?
Oh, my goodness. It's such a homegrown operation. You know, we film a segment on the laptop that we've been given with a little video camera built in, and we look at it. The lighting looks like something like Dr. Caligari's cabinet, you know, like a 1930s expressionist movie. This horrible lighting. So we go off to Lynda, lynda.com, and learn about lighting and video. We realize, oh, we had both incandescent and fluorescent lights on. That's terrible. We can't do that. So in the second lesson, I say, hey, let us know how we did with the lighting, because this is a class in learning from each other, and we just learned on Lynda why our lighting was so bad last time. So we're having fun with it. I begin by saying it feels a little bit like a cross between Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and Wayne's World, and I let the viewers in on the fact that this is very amateurish, but that's a good thing, because the model of learning that we're promoting in the future of higher education is a kind of DIY non-expert, all the different ways that we now learn from each other. And so building the course is really the method that we're pushing in the course. We're learning a lot as we go along.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. The course is going to be taught in January, is that right?
It's taught in January. And then I've got about 40 people around the world who are going to be teaching a face-to-face course on some version of the history and future of higher education. And our students in the face-to-face courses will have the option of taking the Coursera class too, but they also will be communicating across all our different universities and talking to one another and doing cross-university projects. And we're going to be posting syllabi and having webinars and so forth. It's going to be quite a interesting circus, and I hope we all learn a lot. But I hope it also generates a kind of excitement. And this, to me, is the most positive thing about MOOCs. I think for a while the media idea about higher education was it wasn't worth the money, there was nothing you could learn from higher education, et cetera, et cetera. And suddenly you've got hundreds of thousands, millions of people spending their time, not their money, because MOOCs are free, but certainly spending their time on MOOCs. That, to me, suggests that people really want to learn if they have access to education. And one of the other things I believe in really strongly is free public education. And I think we've made a terrible, terrible mistake as a society by defunding public education. It seems so crucial to the future.
I'll look forward to your course because of the subject matter, certainly, but also this will be one of the few MOOCs taught by someone of your particular gender. Any thoughts as to why this new medium has been so male-dominated during its short lifetime?
Yeah, it's very shocking to me. First of all, I think there's something about the sage on the stage, the doc on the laptop, that does reaffirm certain kind of gender hierarchies, you know, the traditional role of the male teacher, and then the masses of students out there listening and hanging on every word. I don't want to generalize. I actually don't like that kind of gender generalization, but the numbers are shocking. Far more disparate, both in race and in gender, than the elite universities that are sponsoring these MOOCs. So there's something really wrong about the invitation and the way these courses are being framed. But it's also true on Wikipedia. You know, we are so excited that Wikipedia is this open access platform, open to anybody, and anybody can write and anybody can edit. You don't have to be an editor. And only 14% of the contributors to Wikipedia are female. Now, given the fact that how many knowledge keepers around the world are female, librarians, teachers, archivists of various sorts, book dealers are women, that's pretty shocking that there's such a disparity. This is another kind of crusade of mine, that open access isn't really open unless participation is equal. And creating the circumstances for equal participation seems to me incumbent on those who are pushing open access to really think about what the assumptions of their system are that are precluding, in fact, a egalitarian participation.
Well, Kathy, it's been a real treat getting your perspective on not just MOOCs, but a whole host of issues. I'd like to thank you for joining us on Degree of Freedom.
Thank you, and thank you for running Degree of Freedom. I love it, and I really appreciate you doing that. And I think everybody listening to this program knows that you've really dedicated a lot of your life to it, and it's very much appreciated. Thank you.
That was Kathy Davidson from Duke University, author of Now You See It, How Technology and Brain Science Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Learn. And before signing off, I'd like to recommend that, in addition to reading Kathy's new book, you also pick up the other book we mentioned during today's podcast, Nicholas Carr's The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. As Kathy mentioned, she provides the glass half-full argument regarding the beneficial effects of new technology as they relate to what cognitive science has to tell us about how our brains work, or at least how we can embrace new capabilities that her history background tells us are here to stay. And while Carr's book doesn't take a pessimistic view of this subject, he does provide cautionary arguments regarding how the tools we think we're using to change the world are changing us in subtle but important ways as we use them. A good precedent for this kind of trade-off is the development not of the book, but of written language itself. For before writing existed, people were not dolts or bumpkins. In fact, one of history's greatest thinkers, Socrates, not only didn't write anything down, but questioned the entire value of writing in the first place. For he was living in an oral society, a society where powerful intellect was fueled by a powerful memory. But once writing freed people from having to memorize everything worth talking or thinking about, it also eliminated the need for whatever abilities such prodigious memory empowered. The world was obviously better off with written language, but we did lose something in the process, the brain's ability to store and quickly retrieve the massive amount of memorized information it once could. Today, our memory is freed even more, since whenever a question comes up we cannot answer, we can pull out our smartphone, pop up a browser, and look it up. And there's no question that having 24/7 access to a library as big as the internet is, like writing, a positive thing. But just as with the invention of writing, it also has costs, including the atrophying of our ability to recall what we can now Google. Think about that the next time you use your computer to remind you of what day your anniversary or kid's birthday falls on. Or remind yourself while skimming through the pages of an ebook, pausing every few minutes to check your mail, how you used to give similar books your undivided attention just a few years ago when they were printed and you were reading them in silent solitude. As a final program note, I'll be taking a brief hiatus from podcasting over the next few weeks as I wait for more of the guests I'm planning to interview between now and the end of the year to make it back from vacation. I'll still be posting to the degreeoffreedom.org website and, of course, continuing classes and responding to your inquiries. And the podcast will return at the start of September to continue discussions with people in the forefront of MOOCs and other forms of free learning. So I'm looking forward to talking to you then on the next Degree of Freedom podcast.